Connectionmedia.com.
Major funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. As U.S. soldiers line up on the Iraqi border, the world waits and wonders about what comes next and when. The American military is a fighting machine with firepower that towers over anything that Saddam Hussein can muster. And yet still there are many questions about the way the Iraqi dictator can defend himself. There's lots of talk about his willingness to use chemical weapons, his history of sabotage, and placing his own troops squarely in the path of danger. On the U.S. side, the message to soldiers is simple. Know your mission and focus on that. Leave the head-scratching to the people in charge. And now, just hours before President Bush's ultimatum to Saddam Hussein expires, we're talking about the U.S. military mission in Iraq. Connection listeners, do you understand what that mission is? Have the dangers and the challenges and the aims of this mission been made clear? Our number's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us this hour, retired General William Nash. He's currently the director of the Center for Preventative Action at the Council on Foreign Relations. In Desert Storm, he was tank brigade commander in the 3rd Armored Division and led the attack on the Republican Guard. After the completion of those hostilities, he occupied territory just north of the Kuwait border for 2 months. He's joining us from the Brookings Studio in Washington. Hello, General Nash.
Good morning, Dick. Good to be back with you.
Yeah, nice to have you here. And joining us in the studio, Owen Cote. He's Associate Director of MIT's Security Studies Program and expert in U.S. defense policy, military doctrine, and international security affairs. Owen, nice to have you on the program.
Nice to be here.
General, let me start with you, because when we talk about defining the mission, this is the sort of thing that even retired generals are supposed to be very clear-headed about. Can you put this in 3 or 4 points for us?
Well, I would start... And I would limit initially my remarks to the military mission.
Right.
First, there's a requirement to defeat or neutralize the Iraqi forces. Second, establish a condition so the regime is ousted, specifically Saddam Hussein and his inner circle. Three, they have to take action to find and secure the weapons of mass destruction that are alleged to be throughout the country. And finally, I think you have to include a mission to set the conditions for the post-war Iraq. And that impacts on the way you go about fighting the war and your preparation for the humanitarian and public security requirements that will immediately follow in the wake of the assault.
All right, let's take them one at a time. Let me start with the first point, defeating the forces that are on the ground. Owen Cote, in 1991... that meant a sustained air campaign over a considerable number of days before anything moved on the ground. But what we hear is that this time it's going to be a whole lot different. Why is it different this time?
Well, I think that one of the reasons why it's different is because there's a tremendous value given our goals, the general mentioned among them, you know, find and secure WMD, for example. There's a tremendous value in gaining control over as much Iraqi territory as possible, as quickly as possible. Now, in the situation where you were fighting to basically eject the Iraqi forces from Kuwait, the control over the ground itself was of no value. What you wanted to do was basically just eject those forces. Now, what we have is a very large area where we want to gain control over at least significant parts of it very quickly. So you want to get ground forces, which are necessary for that, into position to do that as quickly as possible.
And does that mean, General, that the people on the ground are going in with orders that are different than the ones that you had in 1991?
Yes. When we crossed the border into Iraq in 91, and by the way, I was not leading the attack, but I was an active participant.
All right.
Our mission was to go in and destroy the Republican Guard forces that were the main elements that were occupying Kuwait. Now, as Owen said, we have to get into the country. I think you'll see a variety of attacks, but a quick move by some element of the force, probably the main attack towards Baghdad, because that not only engages the major Iraqi forces, but leads to the ousting of the regime.
And Owen, I was reading in the wires earlier today that a company commander of the 4th Battalion, 64th Armor Regiment, part of the 3rd Infantry, told his soldiers to take the U.S. flags from the tops of the tanks. He said, Captain Chris Carter said, "We will be entering Iraq as an army of liberation, not domination, so it would not be right to go in with the American flag flying." In a way, that's a sense or a notion of this liberation mission, which hasn't been made that clear back here in the United States.
There's no question that the sort of basic purpose here has been a little bit of a moving target. And as what we've seen in the last month is we've seen exactly a lot more discussion about this is a liberation of a captive people. I'm not sure the captain needs to take the flag off the tank in order to make that message, but the words that the president has been using have been very explicit in saying that a major goal here is to free, as they would say, a captive peoples, to liberate Germany, as it were, you know, if you want to use a former analogy, from a dictator. And, you know, there's been a lot of talk about weapons of mass destruction as well, and there's been a lot of talk about, you know, the threat that the country poses to its neighbors. But there's also a lot of talk lately about liberation.
And these commanders, General Nash, know that their soldiers may be in Iraqi towns and cities 6 months, 2 years from the time that the Iraq actually begins, the attack actually begins. Does that mean that they go in a more delicate fashion, not barreling up to Baghdad quite as we've heard it described? They know they're going to be there in the months ahead.
Well, that's the complexity of the mission, because there has to be some steely-eyed endeavors by those tank company commanders to defeat the forces and oust the regime. So, what makes this a difficult mission is it's got these two aspects of one, the defeat, and two, the rebuilding. And you know, after all is said and done, thank God we have captains serving our nation like you described, because as he explains to the soldiers why they don't want to appear to be an occupying or a conquering country, but a liberating force. Thank goodness we have that kind of wisdom to rely upon.
There's been a lot of talk in the weeks leading up to this moment, and most of it by the politicians rather than the generals. And I think the one that I want the two of you to help me focus in on is the way that even someone as senior as the President of the United States in some way gets involved in the psychological operations leading up to the war. Let's just listen to a little bit of President Bush when he spoke to the nation on Monday evening.
I urge every member of the Iraqi military and intelligence services, if war comes, do not fight for a dying regime that is not worth your own life. And all Iraqi military and civilian personnel should listen carefully to this warning. In any conflict, your fate will depend on your actions. Do not destroy oil wells, a source of wealth that belongs to the Iraqi people. Do not obey any command to use weapons of mass destruction against anyone, including the Iraqi people. War crimes will be prosecuted. War criminals will be punished. And it will be no defense to say, I was just following orders.
Well, it was President Bush addressing the nation and the world on Monday evening. General Nash, it struck me as notable that the president would take apart or his role in the sort of psychological operations in that way. Is it a common practice, or how did you measure that?
Well, I think it is a very wise move, and it really puts the capstone on the psychological operations that have been ongoing for some time. And as we're able to make sure that all the Iraqi senior leaders and subordinates are aware of the president's message, and it has been preceded, that message was preceded by leaflets, by radio broadcasts, by emails, and even cell phone calls to a lot of the Iraqi military. Mm-hmm. It is trying to draw this distinction once again between the regime of Saddam Hussein and the Iraqi people, and the legitimate presence of an Iraqi army. So It'll be a key element as we watch events unfold on how much of the Iraqi force decides not to fight, and in fact may assist us. I would add very quickly that one of the ways to pass your message on the benefits of not fighting and the penalties for fighting is that those who choose to fight and those who are close to the regime, they're the ones who are going to be subjected to the shock and awe, if you will, that we've heard about.
I think, just to expand on what the general said, I think that it's entirely possible that after this war is over, one of the mantras that people are going to be using is that we're used to talking about the air war and the land war, and we're talking about major components of an effort. I think the psychological war in this case could actually turn out to be really decisive. And I would add that I believe that the nature of the force that they've deployed, and particularly its relative smallness, mm-hmm. is a sign of the fact that the administration, to some extent, is putting in their pocket now certain assumptions about success on this front. I think that there's a lot of belief within the administration on the eve of the war that these psychological warfare efforts are succeeding.
But General, from someone who wore a uniform for some considerable period of time, I want you to help me with one aspect of this. President Bush says to the soldiers, and this is from another part of the same speech, it's too late for Saddam Hussein to remain in power. It is not too late for the Iraqi military to act with honor and protect your country by permitting the peaceful entry of coalition forces. I mean, the whole notion of military honor would say that even if they had questions about their own leader, that they would stand. I mean, this is where it goes almost to a different level.
Yeah, I agree. I'm not sure that particular passage was necessary or useful for that matter. But the overall concept is trying to put the laser beam on Saddam Hussein and take it away from the Iraqi people and their legitimate institutions. So it's part of a larger effort, but not everything is perfect.
And that brings us actually to the second point of your mission, and that is ousting the regime. We'll be taking a break in just a couple of seconds, but before we go to that, Owen, just briefly, how does the military focus on that? Is that completely separate from what the soldiers in the desert are thinking about now?
It's a little hard to predict in advance what it means, what it's going to mean operationally. But I think that at least initially, the defeat the Iraqi forces and to sort of get to certain points in the country is going to be the dominant mission. And that's what the soldiers will be concerned about. To the extent that there's some special units that are assigned certain kinds of tasks associated with regime change, obviously that's something that we may learn about as the war goes on, but it's kind of hard to say that will be something that we'll be doing right from the start. Regime change really could be considered to be sort of a lesser included case in some ways of a successful defeat of Iraqi forces and occupation of the country, obviously.
So. Interesting, though, because leading into this, there's all the focus on Osama bin Laden, and
right.
That gets transferred to Saddam Hussein. And Connection listeners, we'll bring that topic back when we return after our break. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. This hour, trying to focus specifically on what the military mission is in the hours before the expiration of the ultimatum that President Bush gave to Saddam Hussein. 1-800-423-8255 is our number. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's.
You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. This hour, a conversation about the military mission in the hours beforehand. And I can tell you the latest from the wires are that the President of the United States has formally notified Congress that he has exhausted diplomacy and may soon order U.S. forces into combat. That's a formal notification that the President has passed along. He met this morning with top defense and foreign policy chiefs and word from his press secretary, Ari Fleischer, that U.S. forces will soon be entering Iraq, whether or not Saddam Hussein flees by the 8 p.m. Eastern Time deadline. Fleischer saying the only question is what opposition they might face at that time, and probably a good time to check in with what's going on in the Gulf area. Thanasis Kambanis is with the Boston Globe as a correspondent and has spent the day with 101st Airborne Division. He's joining us from Kuwait City. Thanasis, can you hear me all right?
Yeah, I can barely hear you. It's good to be on the show, Dick.
Yes, nice to have you. Tell me what you saw today, what you're hearing from the soldiers.
Well, at Camp Pennsylvania, a couple of dozen kilometers south of the Iraqi border, we saw soldiers doing their solid rifle checks. These are airborne assault troops who would be part of any long-range insertion into Iraqi territory, which could include picking oil wells or other targets deep over the border. Now, speaking to the troops today, I mean, they were cocked and ready and good to go in their lingo, and you could see the commander of the brigade we were speaking to said they could be over the border within an hour if ordered into combat.
Now, Thanasis, are the soldiers involved in any of the sort of last minute rituals that they take part in prior to combat?
Well, the Screaming Eagles, as the 101st Airborne is known, have their own tradition, which is to shave their head the night before combat. And a lot of them, you could see between the tents today, shaving their heads. A lot of them had already done it. And the other ritual they have is once a Screaming Eagle has seen combat, they switch their patches from their left to their right shoulder. And a lot of them were talking today about how by tomorrow they'd be entitled to wear their patch on the right shoulder.
So a lot of eagerness to get involved. Any trepidation, any second thoughts that the soldiers expressed to you?
A lot of eagerness, but a lot of thoughtfulness, too. I mean, these guys are going to be going across the border wearing chemical protection suits with their gas masks at ready and quiet moments around the camp, whether, you know, at the smoking hut or in the TV lounge. The soldiers who expect to be in combat as early as tonight were expressing a lot of concern about what would happen if chemical weapons were used. They feel like they have the best training and the best equipment in the world, but they also know that nerve gas can be lethal even with all the safeguards that the U.S. military gives its troops. These were airborne infantrymen, and these will be the people who will be expected to use their bayonets, to use their guns from a short range, and if it comes to it, be in the thick of any sort of chemical or biological weapon attack.
All right, Thanasis, thanks so much for being with us.
Take care.
That's Thanasis Kambanis. He is a correspondent for the Boston Globe on the line there from Kuwait City. He spent the day with the 101st Airborne Division. This is late afternoon now in the Kuwait-Iraq region, and they had a period of some considerable sandstorms earlier today, but those appear to have quieted down. With me on the program, I have retired General William Nash, director of the Center for Preventative Action at the Council on Foreign Relations. He commanded an armored brigade in Desert Storm. Owen Cote is here with me. He is co-editor of the journal International Security and associate director of MIT's Security Studies Program. General Nash, I'll just ask you what was going through your head listening to Thanasis' description of those moments leading into combat.
Well, I was obviously thinking back to similar experiences in the years gone by. The soldiers are going through their final checks. They're cleaning their weapons. They're probably doing a few sand table map exercises to just ensure they've got timing. And
What's that, a sand table?
Well, they would set up a little replica of the ground that they're going to fight on, and then the various leaders would gather around it and just talk through what his outfit was going to do and make sure that if he was the commander of A Company, he was not only could describe in detail what A Company was going to do, but he understood what B, C, and D Company were doing at the same time. And they just kind of walked through that. They're probably writing letters. A few of them, if they're smart, they're taking catching up on their rest because when it starts, they're going to be going hard for a while.
Yeah, I was reading also that certain pilots on some of the aircraft carriers are being told to go to bed, to rest up, and thinking, yeah, they'll get a lot of sleep.
It's sometimes the most useful thing you can do.
I do want to ask you about the point that Owen was talking about just when we went to the break, and that is the idea of regime change and whether or not that also further complicates this military mission, because Saddam Hussein has done some remarkable disappearing acts in the years leading up to this. And
right.
And for the president to have focused as specifically on that man, does that complicate the military mission?
Well, it does. And Owen's right when he says it's included under the defeat of the military, but it's also requires some extraordinary considerations. At the very beginning of the attack, there'll be efforts to destroy the command and control facilities of the regime, the headquarters, and the communications network that Saddam uses to understand what's going on and to pass directives. I think also we can see a number of the symbols of power be destroyed early on, whether it be palaces or statues and the like. But major symbols that represent to the Iraqi people that Saddam Hussein is in charge. And then finally, there'll be an effort, I'm sure, as early as possible to isolate his personal security forces, be they few in number or larger groups of the Special Republican Guards. And so actions against those three items will lead towards the isolation of the regime and then its destruction. Unlike the Osama bin Laden case, first of all, I don't think Saddam is a man of the caves. But second of all, it will be much, much more clearly evident that he is out of power, even absence his body or his person following the conflict.
Owen Cote, the other piece of news that we've been chewing over for some weeks now is speculation about just what the first hours will look like, what will sound like, the shock and awe, the new armaments that are apparently a part of the arsenal. Does that mean that people in Baghdad probably know what to expect, or is the shock and awe that the Pentagon talks about designed to make sure that they really have no idea what they're in for?
Well, I think there's a there's some misconceptions about what is going to be going on here on this first night. If you go back to the Gulf War, as people do comment on, the percentage of our forces that could use precision weapons were much smaller than they are now. Essentially, all the forces, the air forces, are precise. I think what the best comparison is that on the first night of the Gulf War, we probably used many, many, many more thousands of tons of bombs total than we're going to use on the first night of this war. But on the first night of the Gulf War, only 10% of those were precise, whereas on the first night of this war, essentially all of them will be. So I think from the Iraqi people's point of view, the difference may not be as pronounced as some people think, because precise weapons destroy precise targets. Now, of course, sometimes they malfunction and sometimes you choose the wrong targets, and all that is true, and that's not to be ignored. But it's going to be a campaign that's focused very much on military targets, and military targets narrowly defined. There was a debate within the administration about what to go after and what not to, and things associated with infrastructure, for example, it seems clear are going to be off the list, which has not always been the case in the past. So from the Iraqi people's point of view, this first night of the war and the first two nights or three nights of the war may be you see flashes on the horizon,
right.
Things like that, but it's not going to be a carpet bombing by any shape or any means whatsoever.
All right. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's take our first call from Norfolk now, Massachusetts. Don's on the line. Hi, Don.
Yes, hello. Thanks for this very important and timely discussion. I just wanted to preface my comments by saying I have nothing but the greatest support for our troops over there and obviously wish them to be as much as possible kept out of harm's way.
Mm-hmm.
I think the discussion started this morning with talk about mission and has that been made clear and all that. And my real grapple with this whole thing is the quantum leap that we as the American people and indeed as the world are being asked to make from September 11th to Saddam Hussein. And that fundamental quantum leap there in terms of the mission of this make it very difficult to feel any sense of comfort about this. And as Senator John Kerry said yesterday, the squandering of the goodwill and sympathy of the entire civilized world after September 11th, it makes me feel that much more concerned for our troops because of the dubious nature of this mission. And I just pray that they are safe. And I would also have loved George Bush to have been more forthcoming with his with the discussion about the risks involved. From whatever I've ever heard, whenever questions about the risk come up, his answer is the risks of not doing this are greater than the risks of doing it, which to me is not an answer of the question at hand about the risks to our troops and to the American people.
Don, let me, if I can, take 2 points of what you're saying. And the first one on defining the mission, I'm going to ask Owen to speak about that because I'm not sure if the rationale for war is the same thing as the mission, and whether or not in discussing this morning what the mission is, that includes the reason or the rationale that goes behind it. So to be precise, what do the words mean here, Owen?
Well, you know, when you talk about the rationale for war, you talk about things like weapons of mass destruction. And one of the things I would say to Don about the rationale for war and how the administration has approached it is that I think that the case for this war based on weapons of mass destruction is there's problems associated with that case, I think. Mm-hmm. Chemical and biological weapons are things that I think a lot of people assume that he may have some of somewhere. It would have been nice to have found some of them. But we didn't. The thing about that, though, is that chemical and biological weapons really are ubiquitous. I mean, it's not something that people talk about a lot, but I'm sure General Nash knew it. You know, Serbia's got lots of chemical weapons. We've sort of, in a sense, fought 2 wars against Serbia. It's not something that people have talked a lot about. So they're ubiquitous. And on the nuclear weapon front, Iraq is pretty clearly, I mean, there's no dispute about this, really, years away. And people make the obvious comparison to North Korea, for example, which is, in some sense, maybe weeks away from war or months away. There's still differences between those two cases. But the rationale for war is why are we doing it? And then, the mission, how you fight the war, is something different, which is that you take these goals that you have both talked about and maybe some goals that you haven't talked as much about, and then you have to fashion a campaign, if you will, that's designed to meet those goals. So that would be the way that I would draw that distinction.
Okay, General Nash, the second part of Don's question dealt with defining the mission and defining the risks at the same time and whether or not that's all on the table in the way that it should be, both for the soldiers and the citizens who support them.
Well, I kind of agree with Don that not all of the rationale and risk have been explained to the American people, and there are many folks that are unconvinced. But the risks are both geopolitical large issues regionally and globally, in fact, and measuring how this act in Iraq in the near, medium, and long term will impact on the overall war on terror is one that, at the very least, is problematic. Obviously, the impact on the Israeli-Palestinian issues is profound, and following the campaign in Iraq will be one of the major issues that may or may not give rise to the rationale, you know, in further explanation of the rationale for the war. And I would go back to the weapons of mass destruction. I mean, one of the big stories, if you will, after Iraq is defeated and we're in a posture to do our own inspections, it's going to be show-and-tell time for the administration to demonstrate to the American people and to the world at large that our rationale for taking this risk of war to avoid a risk of weapons of mass destruction was correct.
And, which is why you put that on your list of points that should be inside the mission, right?
Exactly. I mean, my point is if this war is about weapons of mass destruction, show me the bunkers.
1-800-423-8255. Don, thanks for that call to Patterson, Wisconsin now, and Bill's joining us. Hi, Bill.
How you doing?
I'm fine. Thanks for calling.
How you doing, General Nash? I used to be in 3rd Armored Division also, in 3rd Brigade during the Gulf War, and I was a petroleum support. And after about the 4th day of the Gulf War, we had to drive close to 100 miles to pick up fuel to deliver to the frontline troops. And I just wondered if they put any extra contingency for that in case the war lasts much longer.
Well, Bill, it's always good to talk to a spearhead soldier, even if you were in the Thunder Brigade. Yes, they have gone to extensive efforts on fuel. I saw a report the other day of hundreds of 5,000-gallon tankers with which you're very familiar positioning, and I think you'll see the use of helicopters to move large quantities of fuel because, as you know, moving those heavy divisions across the desert from Kuwait to Baghdad will eat up a lot of gas.
Yeah, it sure will, General. All right, that's all I had to say.
Bill, thanks a lot for your call. But Bill puts his finger on something, Owen, and that is, we touched on this a couple of minutes ago. You know, fuel may not be that hard to come by in Iraq, but for an American force that's moving in and may be there for some time, they have to be thinking about food and water and all of the sort of medical supplies, which might not necessarily travel with a force that wants to move quickly and efficiently.
Well, the logistics part of this operation the logistics part of all operations is a very important part of it. And if you look at some of the missions that we think have been assigned to the forces, they're missions that are very challenging, both in terms of sustaining the forces themselves, but also, as you touched on, there's clearly part of our mission here is to, as quickly as possible, create succor, if you will, for refugees, Iraqi internal populations moving around. So you kind of double, and then prisoners of war, which is another big problem. So yes, there's a huge challenge which the U.S. military it's their métier, if you will. I mean, it's something they're really good at, but this will really stress the U.S. military's ability to move all these resources very quickly deep into this country at many locations in places where they will be accessible to the populations that we want to have access to. And very big challenge.
And for who knows how long. 1-800-423-8255. This hour, conversation about the military mission, hours away from the expiration of the ultimatum that President Bush gave to President Saddam Hussein. We'd like to hear from you on whether or not you think that mission is clear, simple, straightforward. 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our...
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. I'm Dick Gordon. With me in the studio, Owen Cote, Associate Director of MIT's Security Studies Program. He's a specialist in U.S. defense policy, military doctrine, international security affairs. Retired General William Nash is also with us. He's director of the Center for Preventative Action at the Council on Foreign Relations. He led U.S. troops into Bosnia after the Dayton Accords, also commanded an armored brigade in Desert Storm. He says he didn't lead the battle against the Republican Guard, but he was pretty near the front. 1-800-423-8255 to bring you into our conversation about military mission. And Owen, perhaps we can start a little bit by one of the things we haven't touched on, and that is that there's a large part of what the U.S. military had intended to use, still moored off the coast of Turkey, wondering whether or not they're even going to be in this particular battle.
It's kind of amazing the extent to which we've learned that we had not tied up all the sort of loose ends associated with this operation politically well in advance. I think, as most of your listeners know, not only has the Turkish parliament said that we can't send ground forces through Turkey into northern Iraq, this was sort of mind-boggling to me. We haven't even really settled on the question of whether we can use Turkish airspace. And as people know, there's a limited use of Turkish airspace and have one Turkish airbase right now to enforce Northern Watch, but that's a very different, the no-fly zone in the north, that's a very different operation from what we're contemplating. This means that there's very difficult to gain access militarily to the northern part of Iraq.
Which may be one of the trickiest parts of the country to control.
Which is probably, in some scenarios, the part of the country you want to control the most early on. And there's a whole slew of issues there that I'm sure that all of you and your listeners can imagine. But there's questions about the role, the autonomy the Kurds will have after the war is over. What happens to the oil that's up in the north? That's another center of oil reserves for the Iraqis. There's neighbors, both Turkey and Iran, that may get involved depending upon what happens or doesn't happen in that part of the country. And it would have been, and clearly the military and the Department of Defense wanted to have a big presence up there on the ground, which it looks like we're not going to have at the outset of this war.
General Nash, all we know is that a spokesman for the Turkish parliament has said that a resolution on the use of airspace may be put before parliament perhaps tomorrow. But this confusion that exists in Turkey and that large contingent that's currently out of the war, if you were standing around one of those tables with the other commanders and trying to figure out, you know, what's going to work, would this be a big problem for you?
Well, I think it's an issue that has to be considered. To stick on the military side for a moment, because what Owen correctly brings up, the geopolitical military issues involving the Kurds, Turkey, and other neighbors are very significant and has great implications for the political picture within Iraq after mm-hmm. the war. But the absence of the forces in northern Iraq, U.S. forces coming down, and also the fact that some of the other units that have started their move towards Kuwait and Iraq but have not arrived yet means that there's a lack of flexibility with respect to the employment of ground forces. Therefore, General Franks and the other commanders, if there are some unforeseen incidents taking place, their major reserve capacity it will come from air power. And while that in many circumstances is suitable, in conditions of urban fighting or in conditions of fighting around oil fields or fighting around sites of weapons of mass destruction, the use of air power may not be the right thing to use in those circumstances. So there is an implication not only for the total force size, but the flexibility within the force to react to unforeseen circumstances.
And when you're planning something like this, you need as much flexibility as you can have. I mean, Owen, the whole idea that the generals need to be planning for not best-case scenarios, but worst-case scenarios.
I think as I sort of referred to earlier in the show, the force that's being used at the outset of this war, both in terms of its size and in terms of its location, to me is not a force that reflects that kind of conservative worst-case planning as far
there's
as
a lot of confidence in this?
There's a lot of confidence that's implicit in this plan. And some of that confidence, as I said, might be warranted based on information that they have and we don't. Now, the nature of that kind of information is always a little inherently ambiguous, so you would probably, in the ideal world, prefer never to sort of really rely on it. I think the civilian part of this government, this administration, has always been leaning forward a little more aggressively in terms of taking some kinds of what some people would call operational risks, and the military has, and to some extent that's built into the relationship. But I'm surprised, and I'd really like to hear what General Nash thinks about this, I'm surprised that there's basically one armored division. We call it the 3rd Infantry Division, but there's one armored division in this attack. There were, I don't know what general will correct me, 5 or 6 in the Gulf War.
General.
Well, no, Owen is exactly correct. Now, we cannot discount the armor forces and the great capacity of the Marine forces that are in the region, as well as the British forces. I would also add that because of the nature of this mission, the 101st Airborne division will have, who are not completely closed, by the way, on the region, but those forces that are there, I think, will have significant impact on a variety of the aspects of the fighting. And lastly, going back to the north, we should remember that there have been many reports and confirmed reports that American Special Operations Forces are with the Kurdish troops in the north. And as we saw in Afghanistan, the use of those special operating forces in conjunction with friendly indigenous forces can have a significant impact and also brings other considerations obviously into play. So I don't know if, as I look at this, I get concerned mostly that maybe I'm just too much of an old soldier and worried about not having enough tanks or armored formations over there. But this is not heavy in the forces like we saw before.
All right, let's go back to our lines. Lloyd's joining us now from Nashua, New Hampshire. Hi, Lloyd.
Hi. Tom, enjoy your shows very, very much. Just a side comment.
But
my general question is, in terms of the shock and awe strategy or message that's being communicated, what targets does that address? And then when do they pull back on that and try to preserve civilian life? Because obviously the idea of this carpet bombing that could extend, that many, many people could get killed in, how do you draw a line, or when will they draw a line in terms of shock and awe stopping and then some level of more restrained combat in order to avoid civilian casualties?
Well, when you were talking about this earlier, can you take us to the next step for Lloyd's?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the shock and awe strategy is the Pentagon has a way of talking about things sometimes. It's sometimes a little unfortunate. I mean, I think the message that lies behind this so-called shock and awe strategy is that you destroy, and like I said, military targets that in the past it might have taken us a week to destroy because we only had a limited number of assets that were really effective, and it would take days for them to cover this set and do it in one night.
Go in, do their bombing, wait for daylight, take their pictures, look at their pictures, go in the next day.
Right, yeah. Right. And here you're going to do it all in one night. And the idea is that the other guy wakes up in the morning, the other guy, the military and the political leadership.
Right.
And instead of having a tenth of their infrastructure, whatever that is, you know, taken away from them the night before, the whole thing has come crashing down. And so this is not – it's just not a strategy that is designed to have a direct impact on the Iraqi civilian population. Now, the problem, though, with talking in those terms is that you never want to hide the fact that there will be mistakes and there are going to be innocent Iraqi civilians killed as
right.
a result of that. In historical terms, I think probably at levels much lower, orders of magnitude lower than in the past, but that will still happen. But the shock and awe thing is something that I think really is a reflection of how precise we've gotten and how widely that precision is deployed through the force so that you can do things in one night, as we're talking about now, that it might have taken a week to do before.
General Nash, I wonder if you can help me with a question that's in my mind. I open up my New York Times on most days and see a colorful map of Iraq that lists all the targets and lists all the forces and shows me as a general know-nothing person, you know, where everything is and how the war is going to be fought. And it seems to me in many cases that there's so much detail there that I'm wondering, from the military point of view, what's missing? What's not there? To what extent is the media, and no reflection on any one particular newspaper, you know, being used as a tool of information or a tool of disinformation? How much am I supposed to be able to trust what I see in the paper and see the television people pointing to when they're looking at their maps?
Well, very little of what you see in the paper or on television is useful targeting information, other than maybe some palaces and some radio towers of the sorts. And I think some of the shock and awe that's going on right now is being done through the newspapers and the televisions as opposed to the bombs that will come later.
This is part of the campaign, is what you're saying.
Yeah, this is part of, and I would say broader than just PSYOPs, it's part of an information campaign that's trying to influence friends and foes in where we're going and trying to set the conditions for the inevitability of our victory and the good intent of our work. So I think the newspapers and television radio have done an extraordinary job. And, of course, the fact that so many reporters from all different media sources are with the troops, this is going to be a very well-reported war, if not completely timely, because there's going to be some special operations going on that we won't hear about until after the fact. But I think for the most part, we're getting a good understanding of what's going on.
And Owen, how important is it to the people at the Pentagon to make sure that there's more rather than less information in a conflict such as this one that's pending?
Well, this administration has taken a very interesting position on this question, and has, you know, as probably you and your colleagues will experience more directly than anyone, they've decided that the more news, the better, in terms of the coverage of this war, in terms of the way journalists are deployed with the forces. I mean, people remember how seemingly sort of hostile and adversarial the relationship was in the Gulf War, and they're taking the approach sort of the opposite here, which is I think they believe that they're going to have it's going to reflect well on both the mission and the operational aspects of the war, and also the goals of the war, the rationale for the war. If people, as many possible, many journalists as possible, see with their own eyes what I think they expect to be civilian populations welcoming the ground forces, maybe with open arms, and the military units laying down their arms and things like that. Now, of course,
General Nass, let me just hear briefly from you on that, whether or not the inclusion of reporters and the type of and the way that we're anticipating the story of this war will be told in a different fashion is something that will rest well with the generals who are in the field.
No, I think so. And I want to go back to what you talked about earlier. You know, I can listen to the President of the United States and other and pundits around Washington talk about the fact that this is a war of liberation, not and the like. But when Captain Jones is out there telling B Company, take your flags down, guys, because we're going to go in there as liberators, not as conquerors, it brings reality to a lot of posturing here in Washington.
In a good way.
In a very positive way.
All right, General Nass, thanks for taking the time to be with us.
Dick, it's always good to be with The Connection, and Owen, I really enjoyed our discussion.
Thank you.
Retired General William Nash, Director of the Center for Preventative Action at the Council on Foreign Relations. Owen Cote, thanks a lot for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Owen's Associate Director of MIT's Security Studies Program, Editor of the journal International Security. Earlier in the program, we talked with the Boston Globe correspondent, Thanasis Kambanis, who's based in Kuwait as we speak. Now, if you'd like to continue the conversation, you can find our forum pages at www.theconnection.org. We had help with our program today from Kim Bichari, Dara Manoogi, and Brian Myers, and Carl Volker. Our program's produced by Sean Carberry, Sarah Field, Elaine Grant, Gail Harris, Kelly Jones, Lindsay Miller, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugarts. Tara Murphy is our senior producer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. To purchase cassettes and CDs of The Connection, please visit www.theconnection.org or phone 1-800-909-9287.
This is WBUR. Coming up next in the second hour.